Would it surprise you to learn that the CIA was directly involved in setting up Wall Street's plumbing by which your stocks and bonds are traded on a daily basis? Well, it didn't surprise me. Let's talk about that today. Hello, everyone. I am Dr. Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity, and we're continuing with our Great Taking series here, that wonderful series by David Rogers Webb, that book, and we are going deep in. Today, we have to talk about the CIA connection, because, you know, listen, all of money is power. Power attracts all different types of people, and we need to know who they are and why they set things up the way they did. Now, the reason we're going down this path, of course, is because, look, you work hard, you save your money, you save it, and you invest it at risk in stocks and bonds, and you'd like to know that your money that you worked for and you spent your life effort obtaining was actually yours. And as we've discovered in this series so far, that's not actually the case. You have been disconnected, disintermediated from your stocks and bonds. You now have what's called a security entitlement. And then there's all this legal machinery and claims, and we've shown that the case precedents already exist so that these things, your stocks and bonds, can be taken if there is an emergency. And of course, we all know there's another emergency coming. There's always an emergency, which is always, always, always a good time for Wall Street to get bailed out by the taxpayers so they don't have to take any losses. It's such a crying shame. You know, when times are good, Wall Street gets all these huge profits and bonuses and manufactures millionaires and billionaires by the bucket load. But oh, when things go a little wrong, they need a bailout, right? And that's been the game for a long time. So guess what? This is not something organic that grew up in a free market capitalist society. This is a state-sponsored enterprise, in a state-sponsored, potentially fleecing enterprise. That's what we have to talk about today. So, what do I mean? Well, now at least we know legally, not lawfully, but legally, how this is going to happen, how you'll end up owning nothing. I don't know about the happy part, but it all comes down to the idea that you actually don't own what you think you own, and we need to talk about that. So look, when you buy or sell a stock or a bond, it's a complicated thing. Here's a little flow chart. There was sort of some names on here, like Megacorp issues a share up there in the upper left, but all the way on the bottom corners down in the left and the right, somebody wants to buy a stock, somebody wants to sell a stock or a bond, and it has to go through all of this machinery. And this is just generally what it looks like. So it's complicated, of course. And in the complexity, that's where the raccoons and the shysters and the bottom feeders and all of the piranhas of Wall Street, the complexity works in their favor. It's a feature of Wall Street, not a bug, right? It doesn't have to be this complicated. In fact, it should be very simple to ask and answer this question. Do I own my stocks and bonds or not? Yes or no? Oh, it's complicated, you know, maybe, you know, and all this stuff happens. That complexity is a feature, not a bug. Okay. But this is what it actually looks like more specifically here. Here, let me go to full screen on this. This is an illustrative of what's called T plus one, means the day plus one settlement flow. So if you sold a stock on day, you know, Wednesday, on Thursday, it would actually settle, meaning it's been taken through the entire settlement process and all the cash has gone where it needs to go and ownership has been transferred where it needs to go. But notice here, all these different things. We have the DTCC down here, that's Depository Trust Clearing Corporation, and they're part of the settlement thing. You've got your retail investor up here. You want to do something, you place an order for a buy or sell. You've got these buy side people, you've got, then it goes to the broker dealers, you've got all these different vendors, you got all these custodians, you got these exchanges, you got this National Security Clearing Corporation here. And so all of this stuff right here, all of this complexity is just so that you can try and sell a stock or buy a stock. Now, what this actually did, what this whole giant system really allowed here, was allowed the raccoons of Wall Street to do what they do, which is things like high frequency trading and all of their shenanigans and the ability to actually skim and skim and skim and skim money. So the Federal Reserve prints money up, throws it into this ecosystem. It gets skimmed through this whole process. But what's sold to us, to you and I, on the back end is this idea that, oh, we're participating, we're investing for our future, we are investing for our potential retirements, we are saving our wealth. That's what's sold to us, but once you actually understand how this system is set up, those things, to the extent people actually, individual, ordinary people get wealthy, that's a side feature of the system. The actual core of this system, it is designed to make sure that wealth is concentrated and retained and the power and control exist within a very small group of people. And so you know who is interested in nation state power and control? Well, the CIA is, which is interesting because when we look at the Depository Trust Clearing Corporation, which we've examined before, but to repeat it very quickly, that is the only organization that manages all of the flows of stocks and bonds. Very powerful position. And this is from the Wall Street Journal. We have an obituary here of William or Bill Dentzer. And they said here, oh, you know, he helped Wall Street unsnarl its paperwork. What a hero. But they actually even mention in the lead under there, former CIA operative. Former. Is one ever really former CIA? That's like, that'd be like saying my uncle is former Marines. No, he's not. He's still a Marine. You should see how he shines his boots and the way he makes his bed. There is no former CIA operative, but let's take a look at this. Here's how they spun this, the formation of DTCC in the Wall Street Journal obituary. They said in the late 1960s, before anyone dreamed of GameStop Corporation or cryptocurrencies, many Americans fixated on go-go stocks that seemed to promise instant wealth. When trading volumes exploded, the quaint back offices of Wall Street brokerages, reliant on pens and teetering stacks of paper, couldn't keep pace. Oh no! The paperwork crisis was so severe that the New York Stock Exchange temporarily ceased Wednesday trading. No, they had to stop trading. This is awful. That gave brokers more time to ensure that stock certificates and payments ended up in the right places. Excuse me. As brokerages installed computers and tried to make them work effectively, fixed costs soared. Oh no, high costs then destroyed some of those firms when trading volume and commissions crashed. Oh no. Oh. So they tried to put computers in, but they had high fixed costs. And then, you know, guess what? It's a cyclical business. Sometimes trading volumes go up, sometimes they go down. And now they were losing money. This is an emergency. When Wall Street loses money, it's an emergency. You need a state-sponsored solution. We need taxpayer bailouts. Somebody's got to do something. This is terrible because Wall Street should never be in a position of losing money. So the problem was there was just too many paper stocks floating around. This is what old-style certificates would look like. And they say that the problem was there were these stacks of papers and they just couldn't manage the whole thing. So what do you do? Well, they bring in a guy named Bill Dentzer. Let's go into his background a little bit. He graduated in 1951, served as president of the National Student Association, a confederation of student governments, a job that involved traveling around the country and sleeping on dormitory sofas and floors. Mr. Dentzer said some of the money he raised for that group was covertly funded by the CIA, but he wasn't informed of the source immediately. All right. Then he goes to law school, Yale University, the probably Skull and Bones, University of Pennsylvania, drafted into the Army. The Army sent him to Fort Jackson, where his duties included teaching soldiers to type. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's what he was doing there. In 56, the Army seconded him to the CIA in Washington. So he joins the CIA at the tender age of 26, where he worked for several years. That's all they really tell you. He joined the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, in 1960, which is a CIA front. Everybody knows that. And worked on foreign aid programs for Latin America. And in 1965, the agency sent him to Lima, Peru, as director of the mission there. Oh, a mission. USAID, International Development. Sounds all good. He worked for the CIA and he sent to Peru, 1965. What was going on in Peru in 1965? Well, it was a little messy down there. They had these guerrillas going on, this guerrilla experience, as they say here, and, said here and, what's going on, and all these Shining Path guerrillas, I think they were, and other type. There are lots of different guerrilla groups down there in yellow, quote, to their failure. What was contributed to the failure of this one group was the small size of the guerrilla group, 13 men, their urban origins. They were unfamiliar with the terrain and the language and the customs of the region. And since their supporters were well known, the Army found it easy to execute them in order to terrorize the rest of the population. Yeah, and he so then Bill Dentzer was in Peru until 1968. He returned to the United States in 1968, where he then, well, I'll tell you about that part next. So what was happening there in 1968? Prior to the conflict, Peru had undergone a series of coups with frequent switches between political parties and ideologies. On 2nd of October 1968, General Juan Velasco Alvarado staged a military coup to become Peru's 56th president. So yay, military coup. So just magically, while Bill Dentzer's down in Peru working for AID, which is the CIA, he was there at a very instrumental time when guerrillas were being rounded up and executed and a coup happened. So this is the long nature of the CIA. They go out there and they subvert democracies and they want it. We want to get the United States. Their job is to get people in power who are, let's just say, agreeable to the interests of the power structures in the United States. That's been the role of the CIA, and they have all these different organizations. And so let's go to the second part of that statement, though, where it says here, after returning to the U.S. in 68, he served as deputy ambassador to the OAS, the Organization of American States, which we can go to another site and find out that the in purple there, the OAS has afforded diplomatic and political cover to the U.S.'s CIA as it has participated in the overthrow of governments that attempt to exercise their legitimate sovereignty, sovereignty that the OAS chapter purports to guarantee. But this exercise has gone all the way from the OAS's expulsion of Cuba in 1962, orchestration of coups in Honduras and Bolivia, attempted to overthrow the governments in Nicaragua and Venezuela, ongoing interference in Haiti. So the OAS, which Bill was deputy ambassador to, was another CIA front. So this guy, he's in Peru, he's in the OAS, this is his background. What do you learn in those kinds of jobs? Well, you learn, I don't know, whatever it is you have to sort of do to be in that kind of a role. That's his background. So that was 1968. Okay. But then he gets a very different job. After returning, they say in 1968 to the OAS in 1970. So coming right out of that CIA role for OAS, in 1970, Governor Nelson Rockefeller named him New York State's banking superintendent. This is a really powerful role. Because there's obviously banking superintendents maybe for every state, but New York is the center of everything, right? That's why when the Federal Reserve was all set up in 1913, part of the job of that setup was to ensure that the most powerful of the 12 Federal Reserve districts was New York. All the other districts are just, you know, they do other stuff, but New York, that's where the Federal Open Market Committee, the trading desks, everything is like centered in New York, New York. That power structure had to be maintained. So to be the superintendent of New York State's banking, to be the superintendent of that, that is a very big, powerful job. And you might ask, seems like you would want to have some banking experience to be in that role potentially, or I don't know, that there would be some other qualifications, not somebody who had most recently been down in Peru during its guerrilla operations and the installment of a government, and then had OAS experience during a time when it was busy overthrowing all sorts of governments and interfering with things. Why would you want a guy with that experience to be the guy who's now in charge of banking? Carrying on, quote, in that role, Bill Dentzer favored allowing banking companies to acquire banks in other states. Well, of course, wouldn't that be a good thing? It used to be before Bill that every state had their own banking system. Inefficient. Wouldn't it be better if you could have just one giant Bank of America with tendrils in all 50 states, obviously. So back then, though, State Senator Harrison Golden, a Democrat from the Bronx, back when Democrats actually stood for things, not like today, called it a silly plan that caters to the greed of the giants in the banking industry. So there's a little bit of a fight going on, but obviously big banking interests won. Carrying on, in 1972, so this is just after 2 years of being the banking superintendent for New York, he was named chief executive of Central Certificate Service Incorporated. Central, get it? Wink. A service created by the New York Stock Exchange to allow the transfer of securities among brokerages via electronic bookkeeping entries rather than by having messengers lug paper certificates from one office to another. He reorganized that operation and named it Depository Trust Corporation. That was the DTC, owned by its users, of course. So the DTC comes along and it is made part of it. They say, Bill Dentzer, he took the solution to that paper crisis. The DTC was a forerunner of today's DTCC. That's a clearinghouse that processes and trades and ensures that sellers receive their money and buyers take ownership of their securities, even if one of the parties goes bust before the transaction is completed. Oh, buyers take ownership of their securities. This is the part that this op-ed got wrong, because you don't take ownership of your securities. Obviously, the whole point of setting it up this way was to disintermediate, to disconnect ownership from the actual thing itself, to decouple those things, because property rights are a problem. Property rights have a long-standing history in the courts. When you have a property right, it is a right. Since you can't undermine a right, what do? Well, you make sure that somebody doesn't have private property. They actually have a security entitlement. That was the whole point of this whole thing. This is money. This is power. This is what happens when your own Eye of Sauron is no longer interested in fomenting regime change, as they call it in other countries, but it's thinking about how do we begin to leverage those same axis of power, those same levers in our own country. This is where it started. The CIA had a man picked who was going to have the most important role in everything, because you want to talk about money as power. All money is flowing through Wall Street at this point in time. All stocks, all bonds. When the Federal Open Market Committee of the Federal Reserve decides it's going to print up a couple of billion or trillion dollars, where does it go? I mean, how does that happen? Well, they have to push it through a network, and that network is this network that we're talking about. It is Wall Street. All right. So remember this Seed and Company? We talked about this. And again, this is from Wikipedia down here. So Seed, they say in yellow down here, quote, Seed technically owns most of the publicly issued stock in the United States. And of course, when it comes to legal stuff, technically is the best kind of ownership there is, right? Most investors do not themselves hold direct property rights in stock, but rather have contractual rights that are part of a chain of contractual rights involving Seed. Oh, you never want to hear that stuff. Like, do I own my car or not? Oh, I mean, I know you have your car, you bought it outright and you own the title. You don't actually own your car. You have a claim. You have contractual rights that are part of a claim of what? There it is. It's in black and white. It's right there. And by the way, by the time it's in Wikipedia, it's been massaged as much as possible, so it looks as good as possible for the deep state. And this is about as clean as you can make it. But still, this should send your hair up on end once you read those words right there. Thus, most investors do not actually hold property rights. I don't have a property right to my holdings with my name on it, my money that I earned. That's now invested. I don't own property rights. What do I own? Oh, yeah, you have contractual rights. It's part of a chain of contractual rights that terminate with this little company called Seed and Company. Now, I think after you've been this far in the series, these words are beginning to make more sense. Hopefully, they make more sense to me now. And of course, Seed owns 83% of issued stocks in the United States, but it goes beyond that. It's not just stocks, it's stocks and bonds. So, obviously, if Seed and Company owns 83% of the issued stocks and it happens to be an LLC, which it is, I should be able to find something out about this. Let's take a dive. What can we find out about it? Bloomberg, Seed and Company. This is hysterical. Sector, unclassifiable. Industry, really unclassifiable. Some industry, also unclassifiable, obviously. Incorporated, don't know. Address, U.S. Website, doesn't have one. Number of employees, don't know. Thanks, Bloomberg. Okay, let's go deeper. How about NASDAQ? NASDAQ says Seed and Company is the nominee name for the DTC, a large clearinghouse that holds shares in its name for banks, brokers, and institutions in order. Okay, but do we have any information? No. I couldn't find out anything about this company through normal channels. I found one article in the UK Daily Star, okay? And this is the secret trillion-dollar company that owns America. This is written back in 2019 by a Michael Moran. It says conspiracy theorists are convinced that a tiny organization owns all the wealth in the U.S. Is it a conspiracy theory? No, it's actually how it is. From that article, they say here, quote, who owns America depends who you ask. A growing body of opinion points to an obscure but immensely powerful organization called Seed & Company. This is the only data I could find out about Seed & Company. This small New York-based financial institution has a dozen directors and no more than a half dozen employees, but holds, according to some reports, some $34 trillion in assets. Are you kidding me? A dozen directors, I can't find their names, and a half dozen employees. I don't know. So, of course, what do we know about the CIA? Why, they really like their secrecy. And if I was the CIA and I was going to set up a dummy shell corporation that was going to technically, which is the best kind of ownership, technically own $34 trillion of U.S. assets, I would keep it as secret as I possibly could. And that's actually the case. So I mean, we can't find out. This should be like, we should know this. Who are the directors? How are they running this thing? How do we know that they're doing this well? How do we know what sort of risks they're taking? How would I, as an investor, assess whether I was comfortable being disintermediated from my stock ownership through something called a security entitlement, giving me a contractual chain of like rights or whatever. I want to know how that company's being run. I would like to know everything about it. I know nothing about it, and I'm a good researcher. I am your information scout, and I can figure this stuff out. So from Wikipedia, it says the company's at 55 Water Street, Suite Conch 4. I couldn't figure out what that is. That big building over here, let me get my laser pointer out. This big building is 55 Water Street right here, but it's also connected to this. And so I was wondering if Conch 4 might be this connector, and that's it. Maybe that's, count up, 1, 2, 3, 4. There, I think that's where Seed & Company is located. Otherwise, it's in conference room on floor 4. It's here. I don't know, but that's it. That's where all the ownership, the legal ownership of all of U.S. stocks and bonds, most of them, the vast majority of them, they exist there. That's where they are. There, I think. I got a field trip. I got to go see this for myself. That's going to be fun someday. So maybe we can find out more from DTCC itself. So they put out these, big reports here. And so I pulled one of the reports out. I'm not sure why anybody thought that was the right logo. I wonder how much they paid for that. I'm not clear on whatever that means. But anyway, this is the report. It's the disclosure framework for covered clearing agencies. And so we go into this. This is from 2023. So this is pretty recent. And in there, they finally have this org chart. So I'm trying to figure stuff out. This is the DTCC. Here is the following chart. It's active direct subsidiaries, which is what Seed & Company has been listed as, but it's not on here. Why isn't it on here? A weird thing to leave off when it technically owns 83% of U.S. stocks and it's a wholly owned subsidiary of yours, staffed entirely with directors who are pulled from the DTCC itself, and you don't even list it? Where is it in here? I don't know. But what also is in here, which is interesting, you have the DTCC itself, right? You also have the National Securities Clearing Corporation, which was the organization that was doing all the stock settlement, but then DTCC pulled it up and bought that in and subsumed it. Fixed Income Clearing Corporation, that's where the bonds are traded. So that's a whole other story we haven't gotten into, but I keep saying stocks and bonds, those as well. Both the stocks that come out of here and the bonds that come out of here would be have Seed & Company as the nominal holder in most cases. You've got your DTCC Solutions LLC, whatever that is. You've got your DTCC UK. So that houses all of their European tendrils that go out, and they do a lot of the same stuff in the UK, in Europe. And you've got their ITP and you've got their direct serve. So they've got all these. This is the DTCC. This was all set up by a gentleman who the Wall Street Journal describes as a former CIA operative. Obviously, there is no former in this kind of a story. So the CIA had an over and compelling interest in maintaining the power and overseeing the power of Wall Street. And there is no greater power than to be at the center of all of the trades that are happening. And because they set up this electronic network, which is overly complicated, and it's just ridiculously complicated, to pick somebody who would be the right person to go from paper securities into, back in the day, these early nascent computer systems, right? Remember back, so when he's setting this whole thing up in 73, I mean, come on, you know, the computers still, some of them still had whirly magnetic tapes and, you know, they were big clunky things. Obviously, you'd want to bring somebody in for that. I don't know, who used to work at IBM, Pitney Bowes, somebody, right? Who had real experience in that, but that wasn't the point. The point was, how do we begin to collect and coalesce all of this power so that we can stage basically what turns out to be a silent financial monetary coup of the United States? I think the CIA is the right person. You want to bring somebody with some good experience in that. Bright, sharp young guy who's who's clearly a player and earned his bona fides out in the field doing these sorts of things. So, just an idea. Now, money is power. This is Wall Street right here, you know, and there's New York Stock Exchange on the right side of that canyon of Wall Street right there. And of course, Wall Street is a fun place to visit. I highly recommend people go there. You can have a good time. This is me on my last trip. I pick the wrong end of the cow every time. I don't know. It's just something about my constitution and makeup. And Evie, of course, not the first person to help those get a little shinier right there. And don't forget, if you're down on Wall Street, go to Liberty Street. That is where the Federal Reserve is parked. And it's a very interesting building. Very hard to get into, I discovered. Not easy. But it's a lot of fun because this is the heart of the entire system. It is Wall Street. It is money. It is money printing. It's an astonishing story. From my point of view, this story was amazing. When the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, the world was still unlimited. We really hadn't begun to tap oil and understand the power and beneficence of oil. There was a lot that was going to happen in the world. Who cared if you had sort of this debt-based money system where we were just printing it all out of thin air? Does it really matter? It didn't. Back in 1913, there were still places that were unexplored. The world seemed like our oyster, and it was. Well, now it's a very different environment. There are no fresh continents to go to. There's no untapped crevice of the story. So having a debt-based money system, which requires and depends on infinite exponential expansion for its very survival, is now running into difficulty. And that's why the great taking has to be understood in the context of what it means to have all of our wealth captured within a system that's been growing like this forever, past 150 years, but it's been growing exponentially and now it can't. This is the great problem. This is the great conundrum of our time. The pie is no longer expanding. Wall Street demands its fair share, which is a larger and larger piece of pie for them because they always have need more because they don't know the word enough is the gateway word to happiness. There's never enough. Billionaires need more billions. Wall Street needs more. They all consider that to be their fair share. And what they have done through the great taking is they have established a system of control and mechanisms by which they will be able to take what isn't theirs because they feel like they deserve it. And that's the nature of Wall Street, right? That's the nature of the rapacious banking system. That's the nature of certain cultures and cultural viewpoints, which is, hey, if you're not smart enough to prevent me from taking your stuff, then it's mine. It's very Machiavellian, but that's the world we live in. So I think you need to be aware of that. Now, we are going on to part two of this for my subscribers and members back at Peak Prosperity. I got to talk about how much time we have left in this story. So if you're interested in that, please come by Peak Prosperity and become a member, because then you get to hear what I think about that, as well as a lot of other things, because I got a lot of points of view. All right. Thanks very much for listening, everyone. Bye-bye.